Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Even as LeBron James makes a run at his supremacy, the greatest ever conversation in basketball starts and ends with Michael Jordan. As Roland Lazenby makes clear in his new biography of the six-time NBA champ, Jordan has long been driven by an unrivaled competitive nature that has often damaged his personal relationships. Lazenby had to cut through plenty of hagiography and deliberate mistruths on the part of the Jordan family and his defenders to complete Michael Jordan The Life, which brings us a long look at the man whose shadow still looms over the NBA more than a decade after his third and final retirement from the sport. Roland Lazenby, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you.
This story starts way back, generations before, in North Carolina, the Jordan family's early goings, and they're facing some really long odds in the beginning. So why did you want to start the story there?
Well, you know, I grew up in the South in a small town, and the schools integrated when I was 13, and I made a couple of lifelong friends. And this was back in the 60s, and Jim Crow had started to come to an end, but the mindset was still there. And I began to notice how the father of one of my friends was treated. And it was something that stuck with me my whole life. And as I covered Jordan in Chicago, and he's such a different cat, I was thinking, this is such a fierce person. He didn't just happen. I wanted to know where this fierceness was during Jim Crow in North Carolina, one of the most racist states in America, particularly through the 20th century. It had more Klan members than all the other southern states combined. And so it started there. I wanted to look at these cultural influences that helped shape Michael Jordan.
Tell us about his family and the different roles they would play as Jordan came of age and grew into an adult.
Well, first, Michael Jordan was unique in many ways in that he lived with four generations of Jordan males. His great-grandfather, who plays a prominent role in this story, was born in 1891, and he died when Michael was 14. In 1977. And his Dawson Jordan, this great-grandfather, was the original tongue, the tongue for which Jordan is known, really came through a succession of males in his family. And so there was a tremendous influence because Dawson Jordan was a lumberman. He was 5'5" and crippled, but he was this fierce guy. He moved logs down the river at the turn of the century to Wilmington, and he was a moonshiner. And a moonshiner during the era of Jim Crow, very difficult times. In fact, Jordan's grandfather on his mother's side, Edward Peoples, was also a moonshiner and a very tough guy. And so that element of his family, you can see really where Jordan has this hard edge, and some of it obviously comes from that. He was deeply influenced by his great-grandfather in many ways. Of course, his father, James Jordan, is well known for having loved baseball. And of course, from an early age, Michael was pitted against his brother Larry, who was 11 months older. And it so happened that Larry was the favored son. And this sort of hardwired Michael Jordan, this fatherly disapproval he got from his from James Jordan, and it became a ferocious competition in some ways with his own brother.
People will remember, of course, that he left basketball, went back to baseball, and much was made at the time of the drama with the father, who in his own story is eventually murdered in a very confusing and complicated case. Skipping ahead in the story a little bit, how did that moment influence Jordan when he finally lost his father, with whom he'd had such a very complicated relationship?
Well, you know, at some point there, as Jordan emerged as this high school athlete, he obviously very quickly secured his father's affection. And even though he had that affection, that really didn't stop this drive to for Michael to prove him, for Jordan to prove himself. But, you know, I really didn't understand the effect of the murder of his father until I had a dear friend whose son was murdered in 2010, and I watched. I'd been a police reporter. I dealt with many homicides and covered murder trials, and I'd seen the horrible pain. But I really had never seen it until I had a close friend go through that. And the families of murder victims are so horrifically traumatized. And, you know, Michael Jordan had this perfect image, this all-powerful, nobody was better in basketball. He had fascinated a global audience, and he was Superman. And, you know, it was the circumstance that led the media, the fans, everyone to overlook this fact that he was absolutely and completely devastated by the murder of his father.
As you reported this book, you've certainly taken the narrative into Michael's life, you know, further than it's been, for sure. But he didn't cooperate with you or, you know, sit for interviews, even though you were able to talk to almost everyone he's known over the years. And I wonder, you were just talking about how strong of an image he's had. How much of that has been kind of a willful construction? And, you know, did you find tears in the thread as you were going along with this book?
Well, you know, I write this as a Black Power story. It really deals with the cultural background. In 2010, I did a biography of Jerry West, the great Lakers star and the logo of the NBA. And I started it with a deep cultural background as well. He came out of the Southern Appalachians, the coal fields of Southern West Virginia. Really brutal things happened to his family. And I took this same look. The Jordan family had been through much in terms of their experiences. And so I began building on that family look. And I wanted to allow the cultural influences, the political rights of African Americans on the coastal plain of North Carolina were seized from them violently in 1898 with a huge incident, a riot by a paramilitary right-wing force in Wilmington. And African Americans, they had 120,000 registered to vote, and very quickly that plummeted down to nothing. And the Jordans, just like all the other African Americans in North Carolina, had no political rights. Their only hope was economic gain. And unfortunately, they were all engaged in sharecropping. And so it was a terrible economic system. A report in 1922 from the North Carolina Board of Agriculture said all of these men are working sharecropping. They're all broke. They're ruining the land. It is a ruinous system. And yet the only person, or one of the very few, black or white, to make it as a sharecropper was Michael's grandfather on his mother's side. And his name was Edward Peoples. He came to own his own land. He was a moonshiner. He also worked in the very tough lumber business. And he was just a fierce guy in a very different way, but that same fierceness. And Michael's mother was driven. She had things happen to her as a teen. Her father disapproved of her. But that economic drive of the Peoples family has been overlooked in the Jordan story. But Dolores Jordan was the one who went out when her son was young and naive, heading into the NBA from the University of North Carolina. She was the one who went out and secured that Nike contract. And Sonny Vaccaro of Nike said, "Surely Dolores Jordan, Michael's mother, is one of the most impressive people I've met in my entire life." And Jordan was very young and naive. He preferred Adidas. He didn't understand that he was getting the kind of contract with Nike before he played an NBA game that would drive his life and hundreds of millions of dollars, would drive Nike from a $2 a share company to the, you know, the top of global sports merchandising. And, at age 27, he started to come to a full awareness of this. But so much of what was driving this agenda was just, it wasn't the black power of protest and politics. It was the black power of economic determination. And so it's a very different story, but you have to understand that cultural context to see how the Jordans, you know, they've always been pictured as these manipulative people who are driven by greed. And obviously that's part of the mindset perhaps of that economic determinism, but it was much more complex than that.
That word drive keeps coming up, and people who remember the NBA of that era, certainly, you know, there was a time when Jordan was playing where it was a lot of, you know, kind of isolation, one-on-one. You had the best player in the world, and, you know, either the Bulls would win behind him or not. Eventually, he buys into the Phil Jackson system, and I was hoping you could take us through the relationship between Phil Jackson and his star player at the time, Michael Jordan.
Well, you know, so much of it relates to Dean Smith at the University of North Carolina. He had a very controlled system, offensive system, so much so that NBA executives and general managers hated it because it hid the athleticism. It hid the lack of athleticism, if that was the case. But they really couldn't see how good players were. And no one really knew how good Michael Jordan was because he had played within this system. Anthony Tichy, who played against Jordan in high school and later against him in the Atlantic Coast Conference, said one thing Jordan has never gotten credit for was having the character to bend his athleticism to fit this very vanilla-type approach to basketball. Well, Tex Winter, who conceived the triangle offense, Phil Jackson's assistant coach, said that if Jordan had not played for Dean Smith at Carolina, he might not have been able later to make the adjustment to going to this very systematic offense, the triangle offense that Phil Jackson's teams ran. Now, Phil Jackson set out, he was an assistant coach with the Bulls, and then when Doug Collins was fired as Bulls coach, Phil Jackson was promoted. And Phil Jackson knew immediately that he had to form a very strong relationship with Michael Jordan, and he set out to do that, and they spent hours talking. And Phil Jackson in so many different ways is persuasive. But by the time Phil Jackson became the head coach, Jordan had been through 7 years of the NBA, and he had become this very cynical person because he had really given up hope that the Bulls franchise was going to be able to do the kinds of things to put him in position to be successful. And so it was the job of Phil Jackson to turn him from this cynicism and essentially get him to do what he had done in college, which was be a part of a system offense.
He had one of the great wingmen in NBA history in Scottie Pippen. They, too, have had an sometimes complicated relationship. Take us through that one, if you will.
Well, one of the things Phil Jackson did, Scottie Pippen, you know, the heart, particularly of the later Bulls teams, were these three guys. Michael Jordan wasn't even listed among the top 500 high school players in America as a junior. Dennis Rodman, who later played for those teams, didn't even play high school basketball. He was 5'8 in high school. And Scottie Pippen, at 6'1 in high school, had only played about a year of serious playing time. He went to Central Arkansas as a team manager, but he grew there. He began growing even before he got there. He would end up 6'7". But he came in from, he was the last child in a large family. He'd come from a small town. He got to Chicago, and he arrived there when Jordan was at the height of all this cynicism I mentioned. And so he was slow in developing. He had some back issues. He really didn't understand what it took. And Phil Jackson decided when he became head coach, he pitted Pippen against Jordan each day in practice. And of course, Jordan was and had been from his very first moments in the NBA just this ferocious monster in practice, demolishing anybody who came his way. And so for a couple of years there, these practices with Jordan on Pippen were a thing of awe. And it took time. But over this process, Pippen, who had these long arms and so many athletic gifts, he came to be this very strong figure who had survived Jordan in practice. And he could then be that person on the floor who could help Jordan deal with all the pressures of winning at the highest levels.
And, of course, they would do that again and again. I want to jump to the post-playing years here. We've got a sainted sports figure, you know, the greatest ever. But in his retirement years, we start to hear a little bit more about, you know, how he has propensity to lose $1 million in a casino in a night. You see him out on the golf course. He's got his cigars and his buddies, and he's kind of running with a fast-moving crew at times. At the same time, he's become a very important owner in the history of the NBA, even if he has a lot of detractors looking at his time down in Charlotte. So how can you judge sort of what he's been up to in the last decade?
Well, I would say first that he obviously has this tremendous drive to have a second act. It's not as if Michael Jordan makes $90 million a year off the court still from all of his
amazing
Nike affiliations and his various endorsements. But he has this tremendous drive. It's very different. And the other thing is it's hard for anyone to have this sort of second act, but it's particularly hard for superstars, and especially for the ultimate superstar, because Jordan had all these fans. He did such magical things as a player. He was all-powerful. He was dominant. And then you saw it first when he went into baseball, the fascination of the fans, but they became really angry because he was a very ordinary player in baseball. And then when he became an executive in Washington, he went back as an old man and tried to play just to help that team learn and to make the franchise millions. Again, he risked the derision of a lot of people. Meanwhile, he had been marketed by Nike so perfectly, with the and also with Gatorade, you know, the fabulous 1991 commercial, "I Want to Be Like Mike." And he really did have this angelic image. And then when the gambling revelations came in the early 90s and all the different things that happened, it didn't sour the public on him. And in fact, that emergence of that edge that was such a part of him fascinated many of them even more. But as he became an executive and later an owner, there was a lot of anger and derision. Yes, his personal life was more exposed. He was flying everywhere in his Jump 23 jet, gambling and golfing. His marriage was falling apart to Juanita, the mother of his children. And he couldn't match as an executive what he did as a player. But he went into Charlotte. His biggest challenge there is that Charlotte was the Chernobyl of the NBA. It had the Hornets. It had had tremendous fan following. And then George Shen had run, the owner of the Hornets at that time, had run into trouble. The community was infuriated with him. And this building that had once been packed was suddenly empty. And finally, Shen packed up and took the Hornets to New Orleans. And then the rollout of the Bobcats was just terrible. It was owned by Robert Johnson, and the trust of the fans in Charlotte just disappeared. Well, Jordan came in as the owner, the first player to own a team, and he's made his share of mistakes. But one of the things that Dean Smith discovered about Jordan when he was a freshman is that this kid is a fabulous listener. And Jordan retains that today. He has spent much time listening. He has backed off with some of his legendary competitiveness. Not a lot, but he has turned some duties over to people who aren't so hard-edged in their competitive nature. And if you'll notice, he's had a very young team. It has lost and lost, but this year it made the playoffs. And this year, again, they were swept, but the fans were back. The arena downtown was packed to the rafters. And it appears that he's endured much, but he seems headed on his way. It has been a hugely successful financial venture. He got a really fine deal on the Bobcats, who will now retain the old Hornets name next year. And with the growth of explosive payments for NBA franchises, Jordan appears to have the Midas touch once again.
When you write a book like this, no doubt you have to spend years of your life with somebody. So did you end up liking Michael Jordan?
Well, you know, I had written a lot and interviewed and had gotten to know Jordan. I did a book in 1998 called Blood on the Horns about the breakup of the Bulls. And Jordan had, you know, over the process of that and other projects I'd done, he'd come to be friendly with me. And he, you know, he would give me sit-downs here or there to discuss things. And so, you know, I had always enjoyed interviewing him. He's engaging in interviews, and he's an iconic figure. His story is not just a basketball story. It's a huge business story. It is a very difficult and troubled family story. It is a large cultural story. It's the story of race in this country in many ways. Even though he was not a groundbreaker in terms of protest, he was a groundbreaker culturally and in other ways because he was such an accepted figure by people of all ethnicities. And so this is a very large story. I very much admire Michael Jordan, but I've tried to be very frank. You know, it's funny, the Chicago Tribune, in its review of my book, said, you know, this is sort of a harsh look at Jordan. And the New York Times, in its review of my book, said, you know, this is sort of a sympathetic look at Jordan. And so I like to think I've struck that balance. The main thing I've tried to do is build the story from the family up and to humanize him and to look at things a little differently by taking that long view from the family.
Well, I think we're all going to be waiting and watching to see what he does in the years to come. And it's been just a pleasure to get caught up to here with Roland Lazenby, the author of Michael Jordan, The Life, which is out now from Little Brown and Company. Thank you so much for taking some time for us. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.